today's podcast, we will be discussing the main constituents of porapora with Phil, the steroidal saponins and other active constituents and its beneficial clinical application for in clinic. Welcome, Phil.
Thanks, Shelley.
Thanks for being here again today, and we've got you on the hot seat for porapora.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's a great herb, this one, and it's all about topical application, obviously, for this herb. What is the main topical use of porapora in clinic? And just tell us a little bit about it as we start the subject on this wonderful New Zealand native.
So firstly, there's two main species that are used, and they're very closely related botanically. It's very hard to tell the difference. They're Solanum avicularis and Solanum laciniatum. One of the unique features is they've got this weird kind of asymmetry about their leaves, their dark green leaves, purple flowers, and of course they produce berries that are a little bit like olive berries in their size and shape. And they start being green, they're green for a long time, and then they ripen to be yellow or pale red even, or orangey. Porapora Solanum laciniatum is native also to other parts of the world, particularly the eastern seaboard of Australia, and they call it kangaroo apple there. And I first read about it many, many years ago when I was a student in the UK. I heard about porapora being used for the itch, supposedly, and used a lot traditionally by Māori for pruritic skin conditions, and that got me really interested in it. It is in other countries. It's also naturalised now in New Caledonia and Hawaii. And even parts of the US apparently. And I was very surprised one day getting out of a taxi in downtown Melbourne to visit a health food shop, one of the Kiwi Herb customers there. And there is a porapora almost growing out of the concrete in front of me. Kangaroo apple, you know, which is interesting, you know. But yeah, as to the differences between the species or anything unique about the New Zealand versus the Australian one, we just need to research it, basically, I think, like we need to with a lot of our traditional species. Traditionally used topically for a lot of itchy conditions, and also planted and eaten. The berries were eaten, including by children, quite safely, provided they're ripe. Okay, you don't eat green berries like you don't eat green potatoes, you don't eat green anything, an unripe berry of anything if you're sensible and you teach your kids well. You know, some people call them Māori gooseberries. Some of the farmers in the mainland in the South Island, where you get quite a lot of it growing, they still call it bulabul, which is a traditional name for it. Early European settlers made jam out of the berries, and it's quite tasty and quite sweet. But traditionally, topical conditions, you know, probably eczema. They didn't call it eczema, of course, back then. But, you know, anything, you know, itchy, scabies, I think it works really well for that. And there's a whole range of topical kind of applications. Anything where there's inflammation and pruritus or itchiness going on.
It's a top contender, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep.
And once you see it, you never forget it. It's very bulbous berries, isn't it?
Yeah.
Quite large berries.
Yep.
Not like a blueberry or...
No,
they're quite big.
They are, yep.
And very pretty, the flowers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, really unique.
Star shape.
The typical Solanaceae shape of the flower, but yeah, really beautiful mauve, sort of purple colour.
And where do we find it in New Zealand typically, just as an extra add?
Yeah, you don't see as much of it, I think, as you used to, which is slightly alarming. A lot of our plants, and yet you do see a lot on farms in certain parts of Otago, and I didn't realise quite to what degree until I went down there a couple of years ago. And it's unusual. I'm sure that with climate change or, you know, droughts and things, it likes certain areas more than others, but you don't see it deep within the bush very often. It likes sun. You often see a little bit like Akiyaki or Didonia viscosa, which is, of course, also endemic to Australia. You see it more on bush margins and verges, and sometimes you see it being planted by the powers that be, i.e. councils and, you know, transit government agencies, etc., which is great. But it is quite fast growing, and one of the biggest ones I ever saw, one of the first ones I was really aware of, was down by the ferry in the South Island many, many years ago at Blenheim. And it was just, as you get off the ferry, there was a really big one there for a number of years, but they always die. They don't last forever. They you know, have a life cycle and then they just wane, but they self-seed everywhere. And you get little plants coming up in a good year. And so it is quite easy to propagate.
And you're right, it seems to be declining, but hopefully with an easy propagation, we can see it easy coming back again and being more populous in New Zealand as we move forward.
Absolutely, yeah.
That would be great to see, as with all our New Zealand natives. I know you've already discussed this, Phil, the traditional use. Is there anything a little bit more you can tell us there, what the Māori used to use it for or what it was traditionally used for?
They as well as itchy skin conditions, they also apparently use it along with a whole lot of other things for certain venereal diseases, probably largely topically again. And also it was used sometimes for hemorrhoids. So it does have an astringency, the leaves. It is mainly the leaves that we use. Mainly, traditionally, it was used for topical itchy skin conditions. And my experience when I first read about it, you know, I was studying herbal medicine in the UK and I was already making ointments out of fresh chickweed, and I'd go out and wildcraft fresh chickweed, and I got to really like it. But no offence, but sometimes it didn't seem to work that well, even though it was really fresh and I thought really good quality. So when I heard about potapotta also being analogous to chickweed, I was dying to try it. And as soon as I did, I made a cream with, you know, about 10 or 15% potapotta extract in it, a hydrophenolic extract, just in a base cream, and it worked really well for, you know, a couple of eczema patients I had. And I used to make ointments in the UK and sell them, and you know, one of the most popular ones was for eczema. So I think potapotta is a really good topical alternative to chickweed. I'm not saying chickweed doesn't work, but you know, sometimes it's hard to access. It's very seasonal, as is potapotta.
It's another option, which is always good.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
One or the other.
But also just wounds and abscesses. Sometimes it's part of a treatment. Traditionally, it was used for those things partly, sometimes as well.
And you've already covered this, Phil, largely, but we know the part that's commonly used with the leaves. What about the berries? So the berries get used all. We know that people used to eat them if they're ripe. Obviously, they're toxic in the green, unripe form, like a lot of green berries,
yep,
in that unripe stage. But do the berries get utilised as well for people out there that want to know a little bit more?
Yeah. In fact, a few years ago, we did a bit of research at Phytomed into the salicylating content in different parts of the plant. And we found that the berries contain a lot more than the leaves. And also there's an element of seasonality. But the berries are probably the best part to use, and it's a little bit like bittersweet, which is another European species of Solanum dulcamara, I think it is, and a lot of European herbalists use that for itchy pruritic skin conditions, but often it's the berries of that, and the berries of deadly nightshade or black nightshade, Solanum nigrum. Also, you know, the berries are associated with having quite stronger effects than certain other parts of the plant.
Yes.
So look, you know, and yet the berries, you need a lot of plants to get a kilo of berries. So I tend to use the whole aerial parts, you know, not the real thick fleshy stem, just a little bit of stem, but mainly leaves. But if you can put berries in there, you need to chop them before you dry them, though. Otherwise, they take ages to dry.
It's just so big, aren't they, in bulbs?
They are. Yep. But
it contains a lot of moisture, right? So
yeah,
they're
exactly.
Very hard to dry.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. Yep. One of our last questions today is, and it's a great question, can you tell us more regarding the research and known clinical uses of its main constituents, those steroidal saponins? I guess this question is very wide because we know more needs to be done here on the research here. We need to know more, of course. But is there some interesting little things that you could pull out from that and tell us? What is known up to date anyway, and hopefully there'll be future research?
There hasn't been much on potapotta, unfortunately. I know that, you know, there was a bit of commercialisation in Australia on their kangaroo apple many years ago. But yeah, interestingly though, and some people may have heard of this, in Taranaki in the 70s, there was a commercial plant that was established to grow potapotta, and from that extract salicylidine, you know, one of these steroidal glycoalkaloids,
yes,
and convert that to diazgenin chemically, which is a precursor for estrogen and progesterone.
Yes, of course, similar to wild yam, right?
Yeah, so that's right.
Progesterone.
And at that time, there were concerns about the political situation in Mexico, hence the supply of wild yam, which is the typical precursor plant used. But it didn't last very long, this plant in Waitara in Taranaki, but that's interesting. But also antimicrobial activity. There's been quite a lot in recent years around antimicrobial activity of salicylidine and antifungal in particular, and including against candida-resistant forms of Candida albicans, resistant forms that are resistant to things, antifungal drugs. So it's quite exciting, and also antibacterial. But the more than antimicrobial actions, though, I think there's quite a lot of research into salicylating for cancer. In vitro, it's effective.
Anti-inflammatory?
Yeah, more as a direct cytotoxic. Some of the, you know, salicylating and some of the derivatives of it have been quite effective against different types of cancer and tumour cell lines. So at the moment they're looking into safety concerns, but, you know, there's nothing clinically being developed out of that. But and a lot of plants have that activity in vitro, but that's quite interesting. But last but not least, the Brazilians have looked at it in terms of its ability, selling them a vicularia anyway, and they've cultured it and grown it and found that it can withstand quite polluted water. It can grow in water that's heavily polluted with various phenols and chlorophenols. And so, like this other plant, this other weed here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, Dorcas carota or wild carrot, both of those were really effective at sequestering or cleaning up polluted waterways. So it's another area of potential exploration and research, because, you know, most countries have dirty water, including this one. So that's another possible area of research for our porapora.
That's a great little note for us to end on, as you talk about porapora, Phil, that it has that additional action. It's very interesting, isn't it? Quite interesting New Zealand native herb, this one, even though you begin to think it's quite limited because it's mainly just topical use, that we're only using it topically, but then it has obviously additional benefits we've yet to discover, but the toxicity is very interesting. Its toxicity binding ability is one that I hope that more research can happen in that area for the future.
Yeah, so that's why we don't recommend it internally, because traditionally there's little evidence it was used in that way, and there are safety concerns the salicylating. You know, you do get some of these solanaceae alkaloids, glycoalkaloids, and a lot of edible plants, you know, like eggplants and potatoes and tomatoes, obviously. But, you know, there's evidence that some of the ones in porapora may not be that safe internally, and yet incredibly effective as anti-inflammatories and anti-pruritic agents topically.
So for now, we keep it in that topical space until we know more.
Yeah,
if and
absolutely.
Where we can expand its use, maybe or maybe not, we don't know. But it's exciting to think that there may be more to this New Zealand nation than what we currently use it for.
I'm sure
regardless
there is.
Of what that is. Yep. It's great to know about the antibacterial. Obviously, with eczema, you often get secondary staph or strep infections with itching and broken skin for those chronic cases. And anyone knows that treats eczema out there, especially in children, it's such a vicious cycle, isn't it? And it's a hard one to get on top of on really chronic cases. So the fact that we've got something topical where, like cognition and dementia, just going back to our other podcast, the relationship is that there's not a lot of successful topical agents for eczema either for a lot of people.
No, that's right. I mean, the steroids or steroids, basically. And
we don't have much
prednisone
choice.
Internally, and they're not that safe long term. So, anti-inflammatory and antimicrobial plants such as porapora are really invaluable.
So if we have an option here to use something else, and often when people come and see us with chronic eczema, which is very common because they've tried everything else.
Certainly is.
Porapora is definitely worth a try here to help that skin healing and repair, as well as obviously internal treatment and finding other options that work for them, dietary and lifestyle. But the topical application is very important for those
people
eczema.
Expect it, and it can often be very effective. Yep. And symptomatically relieving as well.
Of course, if you've lain awake at night itching or had eczema, it's a
terrible,
debilitating condition.
Especially in children and infants, it's really bad to see.
Of course, so if we can help in any way, then porapora may be a valuable aid.
Yeah.
Thanks, Phil, for today. That's great for all of you that use porapora. I hope you've learned a little bit more about it and what it contains, what it might be good for, the traditional use. We're going to put some more information up on our Facebook, so keep watching there and you'll see some interesting things come up there soon, so you can know a bit more again how to use it, maybe some cream, our base cream formulas and things like that, so how to incorporate into your clinic if you're not that familiar with it and would like to know a bit more. We'll just go over today's discussion as well. So thank you, Phil, for being part of today's discussion on porapora.
Thanks, Charlene. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you to all our listeners, and we look forward to bringing you more in our next herb talk podcast, Kaikiti Anō from the Phytomed team.
Kaikiti.